When I glance over my notes and records of the Sherlock Holmes cases between the years 1882 and 1890, I am faced by so many which present strange and interesting features. It's no easy matter to know which to choose and which to leave. Some of these cases have already gained publicity through the papers, and others have not offered a field for those peculiar qualities which my friend possessed in so high a degree, and which it's the object of these papers to illustrate. Some, too, have baffled his analytical skill, and would be beginnings without an ending. Others have been but partially cleared up, and have their explanations founded more upon conjecture and surmise than on absolute logical proof, which was so dear to him. The year 1887 furnished us with a long series of cases of greater or less interest. Here, the case of the Paradol Chamber.
So you see, my dear Dr. Watson, the solution is very simple. In fact, I knew of it as soon as we set out to investigate the case. I have simply been amusing myself. It has been most curious to discover how long it would take those Scotland Yarders to realize that in this very room, the members of the Amateur Mendicant Society have been fleecing thousands of gullible citizens in a grotesque display of self-indulgence and luxury.
And the case of the missing British bark, the Sophie Anderson.
My dear Watson, Lestrade and all those other nincompoops who have the audacity to call themselves detectives have been hiring dredges up and down the Thames in a fruitless exercise. They will never find the missing bark, the Sophie Anderson.
But how can you be so sure?
Because we are standing on her very deck.
Surely not.
Oh, surely yes. The Metropolitan Police have been led a merry dance. They have been terrifying our merchant seamen with a prospective case of maritime murder when all the time I knew it was a case of maritime fraud. It only required a modicum of keen observation. You see, the criminal crew thought that by refitting her sails and quarterdeck and other rather cosmetic changes, they would be able to sell her precious cargo for personal profit and benefit by the insurance collected by their apparently bereaved relatives. But I'd taken care to check with Lloyds that this British bark was the only one of its kind, built at Deptford, and bearing a unique plimsoll line which no amount of paint or polish could disguise. I do hope you've enjoyed our little trip to the Pool of London. Oh, look! If you squint hard enough, you might be able to see Lestrade's dredger ploughing through the river's murky waters. The wind is getting quite fresh. Not the place, I think, for a detective inspector prone to seasickness.
And then there was the singular adventures of the Grice Pattersons in the island of Uffa, and the Camberwell poisoning case.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. I do apologize.
Well, it has been a long day. You're entitled to feel a little tired.
No. No, no, my dear Watts, I'm not tired. I'm utterly bored. Utterly bored. This body here, Mr. George Lansbury, 55 years old, bank manager, respectable master of the Fitzroy Freemasons Lodge, father to two grown-up daughters, both living at her home, and husband to Mrs. Lansbury, a rather confused and harmless woman. Cause of death, arsenic poisoning. Time of death, 23:45 hours, 15 minutes before midnight. Issue to be resolved. Oh, had the deceased gone to bed before his demise? How will we find out?
What's that?
Schopenhauer's pocket watch. 65 jewels, 1862, Zurich, Switzerland. It has the precise winding recall mechanism.
Recall mechanism?
It's a mechanical device which records when the watch was last wound. The only one of its kind. We will therefore be able to establish, since the deceased always wound his watch before retiring, that Mr. Lansbury went to bed within the last 2 hours.
Well, there it is.
Another mystery solved?
Fascinating.
All these cases I may sketch out at some future date, but none of them present such singular features as the strange tale which I have now taken up my pen to describe. This story is so remarkable in its details and so startling in its results that I must give some account of it, in spite of the fact that there are points in connection with it which never have been, and probably never will be, entirely cleared up. It was in the latter days of September, and the equinoctial gales had set in with exceptional violence. All day the wind had screamed and the rain had beaten against the windows, so that even here, in the heart of greater handmade London, we were forced to raise our minds for the instant from the routine of life and to recognize the presence of those great elemental forces which shriek at mankind through the bars of his civilization like untamed beasts in a cage. As evening drew in, the storm grew higher and louder, and the wind cried and sobbed like a child in the chimney. Sherlock Holmes sat moodily at the fireside table.
The lunatic Chirker of Barnstable. Shall I put it under B for Barnstable, C for Chirker, or L for lunatic? No, better file it under A for asphyxiation techniques. We'll never see the like of it again. A most unusual ligature. Now, the butcher of Saint-Michel, solved by blood analysis, should go under blood, but at the same time should go under D for dismemberment.
Oh, why, that was surely the bell. Who could come tonight? Some friend of yours, perhaps?
Except for yourself, I have none. I do not encourage visitors. Yes, it should go under dismemberment.
A client, then?
If so, it is a dangerous case. Nothing less would bring a man out on such a day and at such an hour. But I take it that it's more likely to be some crony at the landlady's. Oh, dear. The garrotters of Marseille will have to wait another time. Come in.
Well, it's my turn to apply my powers of observation. Young man, 22, well-groomed and trimly clad. A Gives Mackintosh, if I'm not mistaken. He must be a man of means. Something of refinement and delicacy in his bearing.
I owe you an apology.
Ah, he is clearly anxious, for his face is pale and his eyes heavy, like those of a man who's weighed down with some great anxiety.
Let me rest here on the hook and we'll drive.
Well,
do
I think I've made a good deduction, worthy of the great detective.
You have come up from the southwest, I see.
Yes, from Horsham.
And that clay and chalk mixture which I see upon your toe caps is quite distinctive.
I have come for advice.
That is easily got.
And help?
That is not always so easy.
I have heard of you, Mr. Holmes.
I am most relieved.
I heard from Major Prendergast how you saved him in the Tankerville Club scandal.
Ah, of course. He was wrongfully accused of cheating at cards.
He said that you could solve anything.
He said too much.
But you are never beaten?
I have been beaten. 4 times. 3 times by men and once by a woman.
But what is that compared with the number of your successes?
It is true that I have been generally successful.
Then you may be so with me.
I beg that you will draw your chair up to the fire and favour me with some details as to your case.
It is no ordinary one.
None of those which come to me are. I am the last court of appeal.
And yet I question, sir, whether in all your experience you have ever listened to a more mysterious and inexplicable chain of events than those which have happened to my own family.
You fill me with interest. Pray give us the essential facts from the commencement, and I can afterwards question you as to those details which seem to me to be most important.
My name is John Openshaw, but my own affairs have, as far as I can understand it, little to do with this awful business. It is a hereditary matter, so in order to give you an idea of the facts, I must go back to the commencement of the affair. You must know that my grandfather had 2 sons, my uncle Elias and my father Joseph. My father had a small factory at Coventry, which he enlarged at the time of the invention of bicycling. He was the patentee of the Openshaw Unbreakable Tire.
Ah, yes. It was used to hang a man in Chichester, and I was able to trace the murderer by the efficient records of sales and invoices kept by your father's business.
The business met with such success that he was able to sell it and to retire upon a handsome competence. My uncle Elias emigrated to America when he was a young man and became a planter in Florida, where he was reported to have done very well. At the time of the war, he fought in Jackson's army and afterwards under Hood, where he rose to the rank of colonel. When Lee laid down his arms, my uncle returned to his plantation, where he remained for 3 or 4 years. About 1869 or 1870, he came back to Europe and took a small estate in Sussex, near Horsham. He had made a very considerable fortune in the States, and his reason for leaving them was his aversion to the Negroes.
What an unfortunate attitude.
Yes, but it is very much a matter of culture and upbringing, Mr. Holmes.
I have never been able to understand the premise that one man, by the very nature of his skin, or for that matter his birth, can be considered superior to another.
I am not making excuses, Mr. Holmes. He disliked the Republican policy in extending the franchise to Negroes.
I prefer to judge people according to their intellect. Your uncle's policy betrays a weakness in his head.
He is... was a singular man. Fierce and quick-tempered. Very foul-mouthed when he was angry. And of a most retiring disposition.
I am sure that the wider community of Horsham has appreciated his reclusiveness.
Well, during all the years that he lived at Horsham, I doubt if he ever set foot in the town. He had a garden and two or three fields round his house, and there he would take his exercise, though very often for weeks on end he would never leave his room. He drank a great deal of brandy and smoked very heavily, but he would see no society and did not want any friends, or not even his own brother.
And yet your voice suggests that you had some affection for him.
He didn't mind me. In fact, he showed me much kindness, for at the time when he saw me first, I was a youngster of 12 or so. And that would be in the year 1878, after he'd been 8 or 9 years in England. He begged my father to let me live with him, and he was very kind to me in his way.
You are a very generous young man.
When he was sober, he used to be very fond of playing backgammon and draughts with me, and he would make me his representative both with the servants and with tradespeople, so that by the time that I was 16, I was quite master of the house. I kept all the keys and could go where I liked and do what I liked, so long as I did not disturb him in his privacy.
Yes, I thought as much. I imagine there was one room which was out of bounds.
How remarkable. You know.
Oh, it is the psychological pattern which I am familiar with.
Well, there was a lumber room up among the attics which was invariably locked and which he would never permit either me or anyone else to enter. With a boy's curiosity, I have peeped through the keyhole. But I was never able to see more than such a collection of old trunks and bundles as would be expected in such a room.
I imagine you are now going to unfold the story of a dark shadow casting its gloom over your uncle's already bleak countenance.
Why, yes, Mr. Holmes. It was in March 1883. A letter with a foreign stamp lay upon the breakfast table in front of the Colonel's plate of kippers.
Most unusual for him to receive any letters.
Particularly when he had no friends of any sort.
From India. Pondicherry postmark. What can this be?
Good Lord. Somebody wants you to grow some orange or lemon trees. I didn't know you knew somebody with such a strange sense of humor, Uncle. Uncle? What's wrong? You look unwell.
I have orange pips. It is the KKK. My God, my God, my sins have overtaken me.
What is it, Uncle?
Death, my dear boy, death.
What was written on the envelope?
Scrawled in red ink upon the inner flap, just above the gum, the letter K, three times repeated. Nothing else save the 5 dried pips. What could be the reason for his overpowering terror? I left the breakfast table. And as I ascended the stair, I met him coming down with an old rusty key, which must have belonged to the attic, in one hand, and a small brass box, like a cash box, in the other.
Let me do what they like, but I'll checkmate them still. Tell Mary that I shall want a fire in my room today, and send down to Fordham, the Horsham lawyer. Every last paper gone. Just remember where I come from. I'm a veteran. Chancellorsville. In Antietam. I'll buckle to no man. Yankee or KKK.
Called.
I'm sorry we have kept you waiting, John.
and Mr. Fordham here have had some important business to attend to, and you'll be acquainted with it right now. I wish you, John, to witness my will. I leave my estate, with all its advantages and all its disadvantages, to my brother, your father, whence it will no doubt descend to you. If you can enjoy it in peace, well and good. If you find you cannot, take my advice, my boy, and leave it to your deadliest enemy. I am sorry to give you such a two-edged thing, but I can't say what turn things are going to take. Kindly sign the paper where Mr. Fordham shows you.
I signed the paper as directed, and the lawyer took it away with him. This singular incident made, as you may think, the deepest impression upon me, and I pondered over it and turned it every way in my mind without being able to make anything of it. Yet I could not shake off the vague feeling of dread which it left behind. Though the sensation grew less keen as the weeks passed and nothing happened to disturb the usual routine of our lives.
What of your uncle?
A great change, Mr. Holmes. He drank more than ever, and he became more reclusive. Most of his time he would spend in his room, with the door locked upon the inside. Sometimes he would emerge in a sort of drunken frenzy.
I'm afraid of no man! Do you hear that? Wherever you are, you'll not coop me up like a sheep! You devil!
Uncle! Uncle, for God's sake! You'll hurt yourself! Come back inside. There's nobody out there.
You don't frighten me. I'm ready for you.
Uncle, give me the gun.
No, they won't get me in the back. I'm ready for them, boy.
I will come to the end of the matter, Mr. Holmes. I do not wish to abuse your patience.
Not at all, my dear chap. Pray take your time.
There came a time when he made one of those drunken sallies from which he never came back. We found him face downwards in a little green-scummed pool which lay at the foot of the garden. There was no sign of any violence, and the water was but 2 feet deep, so that the jury, having regard to his known eccentricity, brought in a verdict of suicide.
Quite astonishing.
Good Lord. I knew he winced from the very thought of death, and I need some persuading that he had gone out of his way to meet it. Well, Mr. Holmes, the matter passed, and my father entered into possession of the estate, and of some £14,000 which lay to my uncle's credit at the bank.
One moment. Your statement is one of the most remarkable to which I have ever listened. Let me have the date of the reception by your uncle of the letter, and the date of his supposed suicide.
The letter arrived on March the 10th, 1883. His death was 7 weeks later, upon the night of the 2nd of May.
Thank you. Pray proceed.
When my father took over the Horsham property, he, at my request, made a careful examination of the attic, which had been always locked up. We found the brass box there, although its contents had been destroyed. On the inside of the lid was a paper label, with the initials KKK repeated upon it, and letters, memoranda, receipts, and a register written beneath. These, we presume, indicated the nature of the papers which had been destroyed by Colonel Openshaw.
Did you find anything else of interest in the attic?
There were notebooks and papers about his fighting in the Civil War. Many remarked on his bravery as a soldier. And there were political papers, showing that he strongly opposed the carpetbag politicians who had been sent down from the North. Well, Mr. Holmes, my father came to live in Horsham, and I think it was January of 85, a few days after the new year, it happened again.
Good Lord. The pips. 5 of them. I don't know about this. You've told me about Elias and his letter from India. Why, what on earth does this mean, John?
It is KKK.
So it is. Here are the very letters. But what is this written above them?
Let me look. Put the papers on the sundial.
What papers? What sundial?
The sundial in the garden. There is no other. But the papers, They must be those that Elias destroyed.
Who? We're a civilized land here, and we can't have tomfoolery of this kind. Where does the thing come from?
From Dundee.
Some preposterous practical joke. What have I to do with sundials and papers? I shall take no notice of such nonsense.
I should certainly speak to the police.
And be laughed at for my pains? Nothing of the sort.
Then let me do so.
No, I forbid you. I won't have a fuss made about such nonsense.
It was in vain to argue with him, for he was a very obstinate man. I went about with a heart full of foreboding. 3 days after receiving the orange pips, my father went to visit an old friend of his, Major Freebody, who commands one of the forts on Portsdown Hill. I was glad he went. I thought that he would be further from danger when he was away from home. Sadly, I was in error. I received a telegram from the Major. My father had fallen over one of the deep chalk pits in the neighborhood. He was lying senseless with a shattered skull, and he passed away without recovering his consciousness.
What were the circumstances of the incident?
Well, it appears he had been returning from Fareham in the twilight, and as the country was unknown to him and the chalk pit unfenced, the jury had no hesitation in bringing in a verdict of death from accidental causes.
And what is your opinion?
I examined every fact connected with his death and could find nothing to suggest the idea of murder. There were no signs of violence, no footmarks, no robbery, no record of strangers having been seen upon the roads. And yet, I need not tell you that my mind was far from at ease, and that I was well nigh certain that some foul plot had been woven round him.
It is an ill-fated inheritance that comes your way, Mr. Oppenshaw. One that no man would wish to share with you. Eh, Watson?
No, indeed.
Well, I thought of getting rid of it. Of course I did. But I believe the troubles are dependent in some way upon an incident in my uncle's life, and that the danger would be as pressing in one home as in another.
And how are things with you?
My poor father met his end in January 85. That's 2 years and 8 months ago. I have lived happily at Horsham, and had begun to hope that this curse had passed away from the family, and that it had ended with the last generation. I had begun to take comfort too soon. Yesterday morning, the blow fell in the very shape in which it had come upon my father. Here.
Good Lord. 5 orange pips. The young man's gone as white as a sheet. Beads of sweat upon his brow. He can hardly hold himself up. Are you all right, Mr. Oppenshaw?
This is the envelope. The postmark is London, Eastern Division. You will see here the very words which were upon my father's last message. K, K, K. And then, put the papers on the sundial.
What have you done?
Nothing.
Nothing?
To tell the truth, I have felt helpless. I have felt like one of those poor rabbits when the snake is writhing toward it. I seem to be in the grasp of some restless, inexorable evil which no foresight and no precautions can guard against.
You must act, ma'am. You are lost. Nothing but energy can save you now. This is no time for despair.
I have seen the police.
Huh?
But they listen to my story with a smile. I am convinced that the inspector has formed the opinion that the letters are all practical jokes. He even gave me advice on how to grow orange trees.
If it is the inspector I think you saw, then you have confirmed my suspicion that he is more acquainted with the art of horticulture than of criminology.
He said the deaths of my relations were really accidents, as the jury stated, and were not to be connected with these warnings.
Ah, incredible imbecility!
They have, however, allowed me a policeman, who may remain in the house with me.
Has he come with you tonight?
No. His orders were to stay in the house.
Why did you come to me? And above all, why did you not come at once?
I did not know. It was only today that I spoke to Major Prendergast about my troubles and was advised by him to come to you.
Mm. Is it really 2 days since you had the letter? Mm. We should have acted before this. You have no further evidence, I suppose, than that which you have placed before us. No suggestive detail that might help us.
There is one thing. I remembered that on the day when my uncle burned the papers, I observed that the small unburned margins which lay amid the ashes were of this particular colour, this blue. I found this single sheet upon the floor of his room, and I am inclined to think that it may be one of the papers which has perhaps fluttered out from among the others, and in that way has escaped destruction. Apart from the pips, I do not see that it helps us much. I think myself that it is a page from some private diary. The writing is undoubtedly my uncle's.
Please, allow me. You must examine this under the lamp, Watson. What do you observe?
By its ragged edge, we can deduce that it has indeed been torn from a book. There's the heading, March 1869, and the following notices. 4th, Hudson came, same old platform. 7th, set the pips on Macaulay, Paramore, and John Swain of St. Augustine.
What do you make of it?
Very enigmatic.
Anything else on the paper?
Oh, yes. It continues with the following date references. 9th, Macaulay cleared. 10th, John Swain cleared. 12th, visited Paramore. All well.
Thank you. All is not well, Mr. Openshaw. Take this back. And now, you must on no account lose another instant. We cannot spare time even to discuss what you have told me. You must get home instantly and act.
Well, what shall I do?
There is but one thing to do. It must be done at once. You must put this piece of paper, which you have shown us, into the brass box, which you have described. You must also put in a note to say that all the other papers were burned by your uncle, and that this is the only one which remains. You must assert that in such words as will carry conviction. Having done this, you must at once put the box out upon the sundial as directed. Do you understand?
Entirely.
Do not think of revenge or anything of the sort at present. I think that we may gain that by means of the law, but we have our web to weave while theirs is already woven. The first consideration is to remove the pressing danger which threatens you. The second is to clear up the mystery and to punish the guilty party.
I thank you. You have given me fresh life and hope. I shall certainly do as you advise.
Do not lose an instant. And above all, take care of yourself in the meanwhile. For I do not think that there can be a doubt that you are threatened by a very real and imminent danger. How do you go back?
By train from Waterloo.
It is not yet 9. The streets will be crowded. So I trust that you may walk in safety. And yet you cannot guard yourself too closely.
I am armed.
That is well. Tomorrow I shall set to work upon your case.
I shall see you at Horsham, then?
No. Your secret lies in London. It is there that I shall seek it.
Then I shall call upon you in a day, or in 2 days, with news as to the box and the papers. I shall take your advice in every particular. Oh, thank you again, Mr. Holmes. Dr. Watson?
Take care, young man.
I will. I am as ready as any man can be for the danger to be faced. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. I think, Watson, that of all our cases, we have had none more fantastic than this.
Save, perhaps, the sign of four.
Well, yes, save perhaps that. And yet this John Openshaw seems to me to be walking amid even greater perils than did the Sholters.
But have you formed any definite conception as to what these perils are?
There can be no question as to their nature.
Then what are they? Who is this KKK, and why does he pursue this unhappy family?
The ideal reasoner would, when he has once been shown a single fact in all its bearings, deduce from it not only all the chain of events which led up to it, but also all the results which would follow from it. As Cuvier could correctly describe a whole animal by the contemplation of a single bone, so the observer who's thoroughly understood one link in a series of incidents should be able to accurately state all the other ones, both before and after. We have not yet grasped the results which reason alone can attain to. Problems may be solved in the study which have baffled all those who have sought a solution by the aid of their senses. To carry the art, however, to its highest pitch, it is necessary that the reasoner should be able to utilize all the facts which have come to his knowledge, and this in itself implies, as you will readily see, a possession of all knowledge, which, even in these days of free education and encyclopedias, is a somewhat rare accomplishment. It is not so impossible, however, that a man should possess all knowledge which is likely to be useful to him in his work. And this I have endeavored in my case to do. If I remember rightly, you, on one occasion in the early days of our friendship, defined my limits in a very precise fashion.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was a singular document. Philosophy, astronomy, and politics were marked at zero, I remember. Botany, variable. Geology, profound, as regards the mudstains from any region within 50 miles of town. Chemistry, eccentric. Anatomy, unsystematic. Sensational literature and crime records, unique. Violin player, boxer, sportsman, lawyer, and self-poisoner by cocaine and tobacco. Those, I think, were the main points of my analysis.
Well, I say now, as I said then, that a man should keep his little brain attic stocked with all the furniture that he is likely to use, and the rest he can put away in the lumber room of his library, where he can get it if he wants it. Now, for such a case as the one which has been submitted to us tonight, we need certainly to muster all our resources. Kindly hand me down the letter K of the American Encyclopedia, which stands upon the shelf beside you.
Ah, yes, of course. Yes, H-I-R-K.
Thank you. Now, let us consider the situation and see what may be deduced from it. In the first place, we may start with a strong presumption that Colonel Openshaw had some very strong reason for leaving America. Men at his time of life do not change all their habits and exchange willingly the charming climate of Florida for the lonely life of an English provincial town. His extreme love of solitude in England suggests the idea that he was in fear of someone or something. So we may assume, as a working hypothesis, that it was fear of someone or something which drove him from America. As to what it was he feared, we can only deduce that by considering the formidable letters which were received by himself and his successors. Did you notice the postmarks of those letters?
The first was from Pondicherry, the second from Dundee, and the third from London.
From East London. What do you deduce from that?
They're all seaports. That the writer was on board of a ship.
Excellent. My dear Watson, you really are coming on fine. So, we already have a clue. There can be no doubt that the probability, the strong probability, is that the writer was on board of a ship. And now let us consider another point. In the case of Pondicherry, 7 weeks elapsed between the threat and its fulfillment. In the case of Dundee, it was only some 3 or 4 days. Does that suggest anything?
A greater distance to travel.
But the letter had also a greater distance to come.
Then I do not see the point.
There is at least a presumption that the vessel in which the man or men are travelling is a sailing ship. It looks as if they always sent their singular warning or token before them when starting upon their mission. You see how quickly the deed followed the sign when it came from Dundee. If they had come from Pondicherry in a steamer, they would have arrived almost as soon as their letter. But as a matter of fact, 7 weeks represented the difference between the mail boat steamship which brought the letter and the sailing vessel which brought the writer.
It is possible.
And more than that, it is probable. And now you see the deadly urgency of this new case, and why I urge young Openshaw to caution. The blow has always fallen at the end of the time which it would take the senders to travel the distance. But this one comes from London, and therefore we cannot count upon delay.
Good God, what can it mean, this relentless persecution?
The papers which Colonel Openshaw carried are obviously of vital importance to the person or persons in the sailing ship.
Persons?
I think that it is quite clear that there must be more than one of them. A single man could not have carried out 2 deaths in such a way as to deceive a coroner's jury. There must have been several in it, and they must have been men of resource and determination. They mean to have their papers. You see, the KKK ceases to be the initials of an individual and becomes the badge of a society.
But what society?
Have you never heard of the Ku Klux Klan?
I never have.
Here it is. Ku Klux Klan. A name derived from a fanciful resemblance to the sound produced by a cocking rifle. Ku Klux Klan. This terrible secret society was formed by some ex-Confederate soldiers in the southern states after the Civil War, and it rapidly formed local branches in different parts of the country, notably in Tennessee, Louisiana, the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida.
Its power was used for political purposes, principally for the terrorizing of the Negro voters, and the murdering or driving from the country of those who were opposed to its views. Its outrages, my dear Watson, were usually preceded by a warning sent to the marked man in some fantastic but generally recognized shape. A sprig of oak leaves in some parts, melon seeds or orange pips in others. On receiving this, the victim might either openly renounce his former ways or might fly from the country. If he braved the matter out, death would unfailingly fall upon him, and usually in some strange and unforeseen manner. So perfect was the organization of the society, and so systematic its methods, that there is hardly a case upon record where any man succeeded in braving it with impunity, or in which any of its outrages were traced home to the perpetrators. For some years, the organization flourished, in spite of the efforts of the United States government and of the better classes of the community in the South. Eventually, in the year 1869, the movement rather suddenly collapsed, although there have been sporadic outbreaks of the same sort since that date. You will observe that the sudden breaking up of the society was coincident with the disappearance of Colonel Openshaw for America with their papers. It may well have been cause and effect. It is no wonder that he and his family have some of the more implacable spirits upon their track. You can understand that this register and diary have implicated some of the first men in the South. They can have no reason to know of its incineration, so cannot sleep easy at night.
Then the page which we have seen
is such as we might expect. It ran, if I remember right, sent pips to A, B, and C. That is, sent the society's warning to them. Then there are successive entries that A and B were cleared or left the country, and finally that C was visited with, I fear, a sinister result for C. Well, I think, Doctor, that we may let some light into this dark place, and I believe that the only chance young Openshaw has in the meantime is to do what I have told him. There is nothing more to be said or done tonight. So, hand me over my violin and let us try to forget for half an hour the miserable weather and the still more miserable ways of our fellow men.
Taken breakfast?
You'll excuse me for not waiting for you. I have, I foresee, a very busy morning before me in looking into this case of young Openshaw's.
What steps will you take?
It will very much depend upon the results of my first inquiries. I may have to go to Horsham after all.
You will not go there first?
No, I shall commence with the city. Just ring the bell and the maid will bring your coffee.
Holmes, you are too late.
I fear as much. How was it done?
My eye caught the name of Openshaw and the heading, Tragedy Near Waterloo Bridge. Oh, here's the account. Between 9 and 10 last night, Police Constable Cook of the H Division on duty near Waterloo Bridge heard a cry for help and a splash in the water. The night, however, was extremely dark and stormy, so that in spite of the help of several passers-by, it was quite impossible to effect her rescue. The alarm, however, was given, and by the aid of the water police, the body was eventually recovered. It proved to be that of a young gentleman whose name, as it appears from an envelope which was found in his pocket, was John Openshaw, and whose residence is near Horsham. It is conjectured that he may have been hurrying down to catch the last train from Waterloo Station, and that in his haste and the extreme darkness he missed his path and walked over the edge of one of the small landing places for river steamboats. The body exhibited no traces of violence, and there can be no doubt that the deceased had been the victim of an unfortunate accident, which should have the effect of calling the attention of the authorities to the condition of the riverside landing stages.
That hurts my pride, Watson. It is a petty feeling, no doubt, but it hurts my pride. It becomes a personal matter with me now, and if God sends me help, I shall set my hand upon this gang. That he should come to me for help, and that I should send him away to his death! They must be cunning devils. How could they have decoyed him down there? The embankment is not on the direct line to the station. The bridge was too crowded, no doubt, even on such a night for their purpose. Well, Watson, we shall see who will win in the long run. I'm going out now.
To the police?
No! I shall be my own police. When I have spun the web, they may take the flies, but not before.
Ah, Holmes, at last. I was beginning to worry.
I'm starving. It had escaped my memory. I have had nothing since breakfast.
Oh, there's some bread and cheese on the side.
Oh.
How have you succeeded?
Well.
You have a clue?
I have them. In the hollow of my hand. Young Openshaw shall not long remain unavenged. Oh, why, Watson, let us put that own devilish trademark upon them. It is well thought of.
What do you mean?
One, two, three, four, and five. These will do. Onto the inside of the flap. You see here, Watson? I am writing S-H for J-O. Sherlock Holmes for John. All that remains to be done is to address it to Captain James Calhoun, Bark Lone Star, Savannah, Georgia. That will await him when he enters the port. It may give him a sleepless night. He will find it as sure a precursor of his fate as Openshaw did before him.
Who is this Captain Calhoun?
The leader of the gang. I shall have the others, but he first.
How did you trace it, then?
You see here? I have spent the whole day over Lloyd's registers and the files of the old papers following the future career of every vessel which touched at Pondicherry in January and February in 83. There were 36 ships of fair tonnage which were reported there during those months. Of these, one, the Lone Star, instantly attracted my attention, since, although it was reported as having cleared from London, the name is that which is given to one of the states of the Union.
Texas, I think.
I was not sure, and I am not sure which, but I knew that the ship must have an American origin.
What then?
I searched the Dundee records, and when I found that the Bark Lone Star was there in January 85, my suspicion became a certainty. I then inquired as to the vessels which lay at present in the port of London.
Yes?
The Lone Star had arrived here last week. I went down to the Albert Dock and found that she had been taken down the river by the early tide this morning, homeward bound to Savannah. I wired to Gravesend and learned that she had passed some time ago, and as the wind is easterly, I have no doubt that she is now past the Goodwins and not very far from the Isle of Wight.
What then will you do?
Oh, I have my hand upon him. He and the two mates are, as I learned, the only native-born Americans in the ship. The others are Finns and Germans. I know also that they were all three away from the ship last night. I had it from the stevedore, who has been loading their cargo. By the time that their sailing ship reaches Savannah, the mail boat steamship will have carried this letter, and the cable will have informed the police of Savannah that these three gentlemen are badly wanted here upon a charge of murder.
There is ever a flaw, however, in the best laid of human plans, and the murderers of John Openshaw were never to receive the orange pips, which would show them that another as cunning and as resolute as themselves was upon their track. Very long and very severe were the equinoctial gales that year. We waited long for news of the Lone Star of Savannah, but none ever reached us. We did at last hear that somewhere far out in the Atlantic, a shattered sternpost of a boat was seen swinging in the trough of a wave, with the letters L.S. carved upon it. And that is all which we shall ever know of the fate of the Lone Star.